Matthew swore under his breath. I'll be there in a few hours. Can you pick me up? We were going back to Oxford. I stood. Fine. I'll call before I land. And, Marcus, find out who else besides Peter Knox and Domenico Michele are members of the congregation. Peter Knox? The pieces of the puzzle began to click into place. No wonder Matthew had come back to Oxford so quickly when I'd told him who the Brown Wizard was. It explained why he was so eager to push me away now, too. We were breaking the covenant, and it was Knox's job to enforce it. Matthew stood silently for a few moments after the line went dead, one hand clenched as if he were resisting the urge to beat the stone mantle into submission. That was Marcus. Someone tried to break into the lab. I need to go back to Oxford. He turned, his eyes dead.
Is everything all right?
Isabeau shot a worried look in my direction. They didn't make it through the security controls. Still, I need to talk to the university officials and make sure whoever it was doesn't succeed the next time. Nothing that Matthew was saying made sense. If the burglars had failed, why wasn't he relieved? And why was he shaking his head at his mother? Who were they? I asked warily. Marcus isn't sure. That was odd, given a vampire's preternaturally sharp sense of smell. Was it humans? No. We were back to the monosyllabic answers. I'll get my things. I turned toward the stairs. You aren't coming. You're staying here. Matthew's words brought me to a standstill. I'd rather be in Oxford, I protested, with you. Oxford's not safe at the moment. I'll be back when it is.
You just told me we should return there. Make up your mind, Matthew. Where is the danger? The manuscript and the witches? Peter Knox and the congregation? Or Domenico Michele and the vampires?
Were you listening? I am the danger. Matthew's voice was sharp.
Oh, I heard you, but you're keeping something from me.
It's a historian's job to uncover secrets, I promised him softly, and I'm very good at it. He opened his mouth to speak, but I stopped him. No more excuses or false explanations. Go to Oxford. I'll stay here.
Do you need anything from upstairs? Isabeau asked. You should take a coat. Humans will notice if you're wearing only a sweater.
Just my computer. My passport's in the bag. I'll get them. Wanting a respite from all the declaremonts for a moment, I pelted up the stairs. In Matthew's study, I looked around the room that held so much of him. The armor's silvery surfaces winked in the firelight, holding my attention while a jumble of faces flashed through my mind, the visions as swift as comets through the sky. There was a pale woman with enormous blue eyes and a sweet smile, another woman whose firm chin and square shoulders exuded determination, a man with a hawkish nose in terrible pain. There were other faces, too, but the only one I recognized was Louisa de Clermont, holding dripping, bloody fingers in front of her face. Resisting the vision's pull helped the faces fade, but it left my body shaking and my mind bewildered. The DNA report had indicated that visions were likely to come, but there'd been no more warning of their arrival than there had been last night when I floated in Matthew's arms. It was as if someone had pulled the stopper on a bottle, and my magic, released at last, was rushing to get out. Once I was able to jerk the cord from the socket, I slid it into Matthew's bag, along with the computer. His passport was in the front pocket, as he'd said it would be. When I returned to the salon, Matthew was alone, his keys in his hands and a suede barn jacket draped across his shoulders. Mart muttered and paced in the great hall. I handed him his computer and stood far away to better resist the urge to touch him once more. Matthew pocketed his keys and took the bag.
I know this is hard.
His voice was hushed and strange.
But you need to let me take care of it. And I need to know that you're safe while I'm doing that.
I'm safe with you, wherever we are. He shook his head.
My name should have been enough to protect you. It wasn't.
Leaving me isn't the answer. I don't understand all of what's happened today, but Domenico's hatred goes beyond me.
He wants to destroy your family and everything else you care about. Domenico might decide this isn't the right time to pursue his vendetta, but Peter Knox? He wants Ashmole 782 and he thinks I can get it for him. He won't be put off so easily. I shivered.
He'll make a deal if I offer him one.
A deal? What do you have to trade?
The vampire fell silent.
Matthew?
I insisted. The manuscript, he said flatly. I'll leave it and you alone if he promises the same. Ashmole 782 has been undisturbed for a century and a half. We'll let it remain that way.
You can't make a deal with Knox. He can't be trusted.
I was horrified.
Besides, you have all the time you need to wait for the manuscript. Knox doesn't. Your deal won't appeal to him.
Just leave Knox to me, he said gruffly.
My eyes snapped with anger. Leave Domenico to you, leave Knox to you. What do you imagine I'm going to do? You said I'm not a damsel in distress, so stop treating me like one.
I suppose I deserved that, he said slowly, his eyes black. But you have a lot to learn about vampires.
So your mother tells me. But you may have a few things to learn about witches, too. I pushed the hair out of my eyes and crossed my arms over my chest. Go to Oxford. Sort out what happened there.
Whatever happened that you won't share with me.
But for God's sake, Matthew, don't negotiate with Peter Knox. Decide how you feel about me, not because of what the Covenant forbids or the congregation wants, or even what Peter Knox and Domenico Michele make you afraid of.
My beloved vampire, with a face that would make an angel envious, looked at me with sorrow. You know how I feel about you. I shook my head.
No, I don't. When you're ready, you'll tell me.
Matthew struggled with something and left it unsaid. Wordlessly, he walked to the door in the hall. When he reached it, he gave me a long look of snowflakes and frost before walking through. Mart met him in the hall. He kissed her softly on both cheeks and said something in rapid Occitan.
Compreni, compreni, she said, nodding vehemently and looking past him at me.
Mrs. Am tout meu corps, he said quietly.
Al ribere, mefi.
Ta fortissi. Matthew turned to me. And you'll promise me the same thing, that you'll be careful. Listen to Isabeau. He left, without a glance or a final reassuring touch. I bit my lip and tried to swallow the tears, but they spilled out. After 3 slow steps toward the watchtower stairs, my feet began to run, tears streaming down my face. With a look of understanding, Mart let me go. When I came out into the cold, damp air, the De Clermont Standard was snapping gently to and fro, and the clouds continued to obscure the moon. Darkness pressed on me from every direction, and the one creature who kept it at bay was leaving, taking the light with him. Peering down over the tower's ramparts, I saw Matthew standing by the Range Rover, talking furiously to Isabeau. She looked shocked and grabbed the sleeve of his jacket as if to stop him from getting in the car. His hand was a white blur as he pulled his arm free. His fist pounded once into the car's roof. I jumped. Matthew had never used his strength on anything bigger than a walnut or an oyster shell when he was around me, and the dent he'd left in the metal was alarmingly deep. He hung his head. Isabeau touched him lightly on the cheek, his sad features gleaming in the dim light. He climbed into the car and said a few more words. His mother nodded and looked briefly at the watchtower. I stepped back, hoping neither of them had seen me. The car turned over, and its heavy tires crunched across the gravel as Matthew pulled away. The Range Rover's lights disappeared below the hill. With Matthew gone, I slid down the stone wall of the keep and gave in to the tears. It was then that I discovered what witch water was all about. Chapter 23. Before I met Matthew,
There didn't seem to be room in my life for a single additional element, especially not something as significant as a 1,500-year-old vampire. But he'd slipped into unexplored, empty places when I wasn't looking. Now that he'd left, I was terribly aware of his absence. As I sat on the roof of the watchtower, my tears softened my determination to fight for him. Soon there was water everywhere. I was sitting in a puddle of it, and the level just kept rising. It wasn't raining, despite the cloudy skies. The water was coming out of me. My tears fell normally, but swelled, as they dropped into globules the size of snowballs that hit the stone roof of the watchtower with a splash. My hair snaked over my shoulders in sheets of water that poured over the curves of my body. I opened my mouth to take a breath because the water streaming down my face was blocking my nose, and water gushed out in a torrent that tasted of the sea. Through a film of moisture, Mart and Isabeau watched me. Mart's face was grim, Isabeau's lips were moving, but the roar of a thousand seashells made it impossible to hear her. I stood, hoping the water would stop. It didn't. I tried to tell the two women to let the water carry me away along with my grief and the memory of Matthew, but all that produced was another gush of ocean. I reached out, thinking that would help the water drain from me. Even more water cascaded from my fingertips. The gesture reminded me of my mother's arm reaching toward my father, and the waves increased. As the water poured forth, my control slipped further. Domenico's sudden appearance had frightened me more than I'd been willing to admit. Matthew was gone, and I had vowed to fight for him against enemies I couldn't identify and didn't understand. It was now clear that Matthew's past was not composed simply of homely elements of firelight, wine, and books, nor had it unfolded solely within the limits of a loyal family. Domenico had alluded to something darker that was full of enmity, danger, and death. Exhaustion overtook me, and the water pulled me under. A strange sense of exhilaration accompanied the fatigue. I was poised between mortality and something elemental that held within it the promise of a vast, incomprehensible power. If I surrendered to the undertow, there would be no more Diana Bishop. Instead, I would become water, nowhere, everywhere, free of my body and the pain. "I'm sorry, Matthew." My words were nothing more than a burble as the water began its inexorable work. Isabeau stepped toward me, and a sharp crack sounded in my brain. My warning to her was lost in a roar like a tidal wave coming ashore. The winds rose around my feet, whipping the water into a hurricane. I raised my arms to the sky, water and wind shaping themselves into a funnel that encircled my body. Mart grabbed Isabeau's arm, her mouth moving rapidly. Matthew's mother tried to pull away, her own mouth shaping the word no, but Mart held on, staring at her fixedly. After a few moments, Isabeau's shoulders slumped. She turned toward me and started to sing. Haunting and yearning, her voice penetrated the water and called me back to the world. The winds began to die down. The De Clermont standard, which had been whipping around, resumed its gentle swaying. The cascade of water from my fingertips slowed to a river, then to a trickle, and stopped entirely. The waves flowing from my hair subsided into swells, and then they too disappeared. At last, nothing came out of my mouth but a gasp of surprise. The balls of water falling from my eyes were the last vestige of the witch water to disappear, just as they had been the first sign of its power moving through me. The remains of my deluge sluiced toward small holes at the base of the crenellated walls. Far, far below, water splashed onto the courtyard's thick bed of gravel. When the last of the water left me, I felt scooped out like a pumpkin, and freezing cold, too. My knees buckled, banging painfully on the stone.
"Thank God," Isabeau murmured. "We almost lost her."
I was shaking violently from exhaustion and cold. Both women flew at me and lifted me to my feet. They each gripped an elbow and supported me down the curving flight of stairs with a speed that made me shiver. Once in the hall, Mart headed toward Matthew's rooms, and Isabeau pulled in the opposite direction.
"Mina closer," Matthew's mother said sharply.
"She will feel safer closer to him,"
Mart said.
With a sound of exasperation, Isabeau conceded. At the bottom of Matthew's staircase, Isabeau blurted out a string of colorful phrases that sounded totally incongruous coming from her delicate mouth.
"I'll carry her,"
she said, when she was finished cursing her son, the forces of nature, the powers of the universe, and many other unspecified individuals of questionable parentage who'd taken part in building the tower.
Isabeau lifted my much larger body easily. Why he had to make these stairs so twisting and in two separate flights is beyond my understanding.
Mart tucked my wet hair into the crook of Isabeau's elbow and shrugged.
To make it harder, of course. He has always made things harder. For him, for everyone else, too.
No one had thought to come up in the late afternoon to light the candles, but the fire still smoldered and the room retained some of its warmth. Mart disappeared into the bathroom, and the sound of running water made me examine my fingers with alarm. Isabeau threw two enormous logs onto the grate as if they were kindling, snapping a long splinter off of one before it caught. She stirred the coals into flames with it, and then used it to light a dozen candles in the space of a few seconds. In their warm glow, she surveyed me anxiously from head to foot.
"You will never forgive me if you become ill," she said, picking up my hands and examining my nails.
They were bluish again, but not from electricity. Now they were blue with cold and wrinkled from witch water. She rubbed them vigorously between her palms. Still shaking so much that my teeth were chattering, I withdrew my hands to hug myself in an attempt to conserve what little warmth was left in my body. Isabeau picked me up again without ceremony and swept me into the bathroom.
"She needs to be in there now," Isabeau said brusquely.
The room was full of steam, and Mart turned from the bath to help strip off my clothes. Soon I was naked, and the two of them were lifting me into the hot water, one cold vampiric hand in each armpit. The shock of the water's heat on my frigid skin was extreme. Crying out, I struggled to pull myself from Matthew's deep bathtub.
"Shh,"
Isabeau said, holding my hair away from my face while Mart pushed me back into the water.
"It will warm you. We must get you warm."
Mart stood sentinel at one end of the tub, and Isabeau remained at the other, whispering soothing sounds and humming softly under her breath. It was a long time before the shaking stopped. At one point, Mart murmured something in Occitan that included the name Marcus. Isabeau and I said no at the same moment.
"I'll be fine. Don't tell Marcus what happened.
Matthew mustn't know about the magic, not now," I said through chattering teeth.
"We just need some time to warm you."
Isabeau sounded calm, but she looked concerned.
Slowly, the heat began to reverse the changes the witch water had worked on my body.
Mart kept adding fresh hot water to the tub as my body cooled it down. Isabeau grabbed a beat-up tin pitcher from under the window and dipped it into the bath, pouring hot water over my head and shoulders. Once my head was warm, she wrapped it in a towel and pushed me slightly lower in the water.
"Soak," she commanded.
Mart bustled between the bathroom and the bedroom, carrying clothes and towels. She tutted over my lack of pajamas and the old yoga clothes I'd brought to sleep in. None of them met her requirements for warmth. Isabeau felt my cheeks and the top of my head with the back of her hand. She nodded. They let me get myself out of the tub. The water falling off my body reminded me of the watchtower roof, and I dug my toes into the floor to resist the element's insidious pull. Mart and Isabeau bundled me into towels fresh from the fireside that smelled faintly of wood smoke. In the bedroom, they somehow managed to dry me without ever exposing an inch of my flesh to the air, rolling me this way and that inside the towels until I could feel heat radiating from my body. Rough strokes of another towel scratched against my hair before Mart's fingers raked through the strands and twisted them into a tight braid against my scalp. Isabeau tossed the damp towels onto a chair near the fire as I shed them to dress, seemingly unconcerned by their contact with antique wood and fine upholstery. Now, fully clothed, I sat down and stared mindlessly at the fire. Mart disappeared without a word into the lower regions of the chateau and returned with a tray of tiny sandwiches and a steaming pot of her herbal tea.
You will eat. Now.
It was not a request, but a command. I brought one of the sandwiches to my mouth and nibbled around the edges. Mart's eyes narrowed at this sudden change in my eating habits.
Eat.
The food tasted like sawdust, but my stomach rumbled nonetheless. After I'd swallowed two of the tiny sandwiches, Mart thrust a mug into my hands. She didn't need to tell me to drink. The hot liquid slid down my throat, carrying away the water's salty vestiges. Was that witch water? I shivered at the memory of all that water coming out of me. Isabeau, who'd been standing by the window looking out into the darkness, walked toward the opposite sofa.
Yes, she said. It has been a long time, though, since we have seen it come forth like that.
Thank God that wasn't the usual way, I said faintly, swallowing another sip of tea.
Most witches today are not powerful enough to draw on the witch water as you did. They can make waves on ponds and cause rain when there are clouds. They do not become the water.
Isabeau sat across from me, studying me with evident curiosity. I had become the water. Knowing that this was no longer common made me feel vulnerable, and even more alone. A phone rang. Isabeau reached into her pocket and pulled out a small red phone that seemed uncharacteristically bright and high-tech against her pale skin and classic, buff-colored clothes.
Oui? Ah, good. I'm glad that you are there safe.
She spoke English out of courtesy to me and nodded in my direction.
Yes, she is fine. She is eating.
She stood and handed me the phone.
Mathieu would like to speak with you.
Diana? Mathieu was barely audible.
Yes?
I didn't trust myself to say much, for fear that more than words would tumble out. He made a soft sound of relief.
I just wanted to make sure you were all right.
Your mother and Mart are taking good care of me. And I didn't flood the castle, I thought.
You're tired.
The distance between us was making him anxious, and he was tuned into every nuance of our exchange.
I am. It's been a long day. Sleep, then, he said, his tone unexpectedly gentle.
My eyes closed against the sudden sting of tears. There would be little sleep for me tonight. I was too worried about what he might do in some half-baked, heroic attempt to protect me.
Have you been to the lab?
I'm headed there now. Marcus wants me to go over everything carefully and make sure we've taken all the necessary precautions. Miriam's checked the security at the house as well.
He told the half-truth with smooth conviction, but I knew it for what it was. The silence stretched out until it became uncomfortable.
Don't do it, Mathieu. Please don't try to negotiate with Knox.
I'll make sure you're safe before you return to Oxford.
Then there's nothing more to say. You've decided, so have I. I returned the phone to Isabeau. She frowned, her cold fingers pulling it from my grip. Isabeau said goodbye to her son, his reply audible only as a staccato burst of unintelligible sound.
Thank you for not telling him about the witch water, I said quietly after she'd disconnected the line. That is your tale to tell, not mine.
Isabeau drifted toward the fireplace. It's no good trying to tell a story you don't understand. Why is the power coming out now? First it was the wind, then the visions, and now the water, too. I shuddered.
What kind of visions? Isabeau asked, her curiosity evident.
Didn't Mathieu tell you? My DNA has all this magic, I said, stumbling over the word, in it. The tests warned there might be visions, and they'd begun.
Mathieu would never tell me what your blood revealed, certainly not without your permission, and probably not with your permission either.
I've seen them here in the chateau. I hesitated. How did you learn to control them?
Mathieu told you that I had visions before I became a vampire?
Isabeau shook her head.
He should not have. Were you a witch?
That might explain why she disliked me so much.
A witch?
No. Mathieu wonders if I was a demon, but I'm sure I was an ordinary human. They have their visionaries too. It's not only creatures who are blessed and cursed in this way.
Did you ever manage to control your second sight and anticipate it?
It gets easier. There are warning signs. They can be subtle, but you will learn.
Marthe helped me as well.
It was the only piece of information I had about Marthe's past. Not for the first time, I wondered how old these two women were, and what workings of fate had brought them together.
Marthe stood with her arms crossed.
Och, she said, giving Isabeau a tender, protective look. It is easier if you let the visions move through you without fighting.
I'm too shocked to fight, I said, thinking back to the salon and the library.
Shock is your body's way of resisting, Isabeau said. You must try to relax.
It's difficult to let go when you see knights in armor and the faces of women you'd never met mixed up with scenes from your own past. My jaw cracked with a yawn.
You are too exhausted to think about this now.
Isabeau rose to her feet.
I'm not ready to sleep.
I smothered another yawn with the back of my hand. She eyed me speculatively, like a beautiful falcon scrutinizing a field mouse. Isabeau's glance turned mischievous.
Get into bed, and I will tell you how I made Mathieu.
Her offer was too tempting to resist. I did as she told me while she pulled up a chair, and Marthe busied herself with dishes and towels.
So, where do I begin?
She drew herself straighter in the chair and stared into the candle's flames.
I cannot begin simply with my part of the story, but must start with his birth here in the village. I remember him as a baby, you know. His father and mother came when Philippe decided to build on this land back when Clovis was king. That's the only reason the village is here. It was where the farmers and the craftsmen who built the church and castle lived.
Why did your husband pick this spot? I leaned against the pillows, my knees folded close to my chest under the bedclothes.
Clovis promised him the land in hopes it would encourage Philippe to fight against the king's rivals. My husband was always playing both sides against the middle.
Isabeau smiled wistfully.
Very few people caught him at it, though.
Was Matthew's father a farmer?
A farmer?
Isabeau looked surprised.
No, he was a carpenter, as was Mathieu, before he became a stonemason.
A mason. The tower's stones all fit together so smoothly they didn't seem to require mortar, and there were the oddly ornate chimneys at the old lodge gatehouse that Mathieu had just let some craftsman try his hand at constructing. His long, slender fingers were strong enough to twist open an oyster shell or crack a chestnut. Another piece of Mathieu fell into place, fitting perfectly next to the warrior, the scientist, and the courtier. And they both worked on the chateau?
Not this chateau, Isabeau said, looking around her. This was a present from Mathieu, when I was sad over being forced to leave a place that I loved. He tore down the fortress his father had built and replaced it with a new one.
Her green and black eyes glittered with amusement.
Philippe was furious. But it was time for a change. The first chateau was made of wood, and even though there had been stone additions over the years, it was a bit ramshackle.
My mind tried to take in the timeline of events, from the construction of the first fortress and its village in the 6th century to Matthew's tower in the 13th century.
Isabeau's nose crinkled in distaste. Then he stuck this tower onto the back when he returned home and didn't want to live so close to the family. I never liked it. It seemed a romantic trifle, but it was his wish, and I let him.
She shrugged.
Such a funny tower. It didn't help defend the castle. He had already built far more towers here than we needed.
Isabeau continued to spin her tale, seeming only partially in the 21st century.
Mathieu was born in the village. He was always such a bright child, so curious. He drove his father mad, following him to the chateau and picking up tools and sticks and stones.
Children learned their trades early then, but Mathieu was precocious. By the time he could hold a hatchet without injuring himself, he was put to work.
An 8-year-old Matthew with gangly legs and grey-green eyes ran around the hills in my imagination.
Yes, she smiled, agreeing with my unspoken thoughts. He was indeed a beautiful child. A beautiful young man as well.
Mathieu was unusually tall for the time, though not as tall as he became once he was a vampire.
And he had a wicked sense of humor.
He was always pretending that something had gone wrong, or that instructions had not been given to him regarding this roof beam or that foundation. Philippe never failed to believe the tall tales Mathieu told him.
Isabeau's voice was indulgent.
Mathieu's first father died when he was in his late teens, and his first mother had been dead for years by then. He was alone, and we worried about him finding a woman to settle down with and start a family. And then he met Blanca.
Isabeau paused, her look level and without malice.
You cannot have imagined that he was without the love of women.
It was a statement, not a question. Mart shot Isabeau an evil look, but kept quiet. Of course not, I said calmly, though my heart felt heavy.
Blanca was new to the village, a servant to one of the master masons Philippe had brought in from Ravenna to construct the first church. She was as pale as her name suggested, with white skin, eyes the color of a spring sky, and hair that looked like spun gold. A pale, beautiful woman had appeared in my visions when I went to fetch Matthew's computer. Isabeau's description of Blanca fit her perfectly.
She had a sweet smile, didn't she? I whispered.
Isabeau's eyes widened.
Yes, she did.
I know. I saw her when Matthew's armor caught the light in his study. Mart made a warning sound, but Isabeau continued.
Sometimes Blanca seemed so delicate that I feared she would break when drawing water from the well or picking vegetables. My Mathieu was drawn to that delicacy, I suppose. He has always liked fragile things.
Isabeau's eyes flickered over my far-from-fragile form.
They were married when Mathieu turned 25 and could support a family. Blanca was just 19. They were a beautiful couple, of course. There was such a strong contrast between Mathieu's darkness and Blanca's pale prettiness. They were very much in love, and the marriage was a happy one. But they could not seem to have children. Blanca had miscarriage after miscarriage. I cannot imagine what it was like inside their house, to see so many children of your body die before they draw breath. I wasn't sure if vampires could cry, though I remembered the blood-stained tear on Isabeau's cheek from my earlier visions in the salon. Even without the tears, however, she looked now as though she were weeping, her face a mask of regret.
Finally, after so many years of trying and failing, Blanca was with child. It was 531, such a year. There was a new king to the south, and the battles had started all over again.
Mathieu began to look happy, as if he dared to hope this baby would survive. And it did. Lucas was born in the autumn, and was baptized in the unfinished church that Mathieu was helping to build. It was a hard birth for Blanca. The midwife said that he would be the last child she bore. For Mathieu, though, Lucas was enough. And he was so like his father, with his black curls and pointed chin and those long legs.
What happened to Blanca and Lucas? I asked softly.
We were only 6 years from Matthew's transformation into a vampire. Something must have happened, or he would never have let Isabeau exchange his life for a new one.
Mathieu and Blanca watched their son grow and thrive. Mathieu had learned to work in stone rather than wood, and he was in high demand among the lords from here to Paris. Then fever came to the village. Everyone fell ill. Mathieu survived. Blanca and Lucas did not. That was in 536. The year before had been strange, with very little sunshine, and the winter was cold. When spring came, the sickness came too, and carried Blanca and Lucas away.
Didn't the villagers wonder why you and Philippe remained healthy?
Of course. But there were more explanations then than there would be today.
It was easier to think God was angry with the village, or that the castle was cursed, than to think that the Mangesang were living among them.
Mangesang? I tried to roll the syllables around in my mouth as Isabeau had.
It is the old tongue's word for vampire, blood-eater. There were those who suspected the truth and whispered by the fireside, but in those days, the return of the Ostrogoth warriors was a far more frightening prospect than the Mangesang overlord. Philippe promised the villages protection if the raiders came back. Besides, we made it a point never to feed close to home, she explained primly.
What did Matthew do after Blanca and Lucas were gone?
He grieved. Matthew was inconsolable. He stopped eating. He looked like a skeleton, and the village came to us for help. I took him food, Isabeau smiled at Mart, and made him eat and walked with him until he wasn't so restless. When he could not sleep, we went to church and prayed for the souls of Blanca and Lucas. Matthew was very religious in those days. We talked about heaven and hell, and he worried about where their souls were and if he would be able to find them again. Matthew was so gentle with me when I woke up in terror. Had the nights before he'd become a vampire been as sleepless as those that came after? By autumn, he seemed more hopeful. But the winter was difficult. People were hungry, and the sickness continued. Death was everywhere. The spring could not lift the gloom. Philippe was anxious about the church's progress, and Matthew worked harder than ever. At the beginning of the second week in June, he was found on the floor beneath its vaulted ceiling, his legs and back broken. I gasped at the thought of Matthew's soft, human body plummeting to the hard stones. There was no way he could survive the fall, of course, Isabeau said softly. He was a dying man. Some of the masons said he'd slipped. Others said he was standing on the scaffolding one moment and gone the next. They thought Matthew had jumped, and were already talking about how he could not be buried in the church because he was a suicide. I could not let him die, fearing that he might not be saved from hell. He was so worried about being with Blanca and Lucas. How could he go to his death, wondering if he would be separated from them for all eternity?
You did the right thing. It would have been impossible for me to walk away from him, no matter what the state of his soul. Leaving his body broken and hurting was unthinkable. If my blood would have saved him, I would have used it.
Did I? Isabeau shook her head. I have never been sure. Philippe told me it was my decision whether to make Matthew one of our family. I had made other vampires with my blood, and I would make others after him. But Matthew was different. I was fond of him, and I knew that the gods were giving me a chance to make him my child. It would be my responsibility to teach him how a vampire must be in the world.
Did Matthew resist you? I asked, unable to stop myself.
No, she replied. He was out of his mind with pain. We told everyone to leave, saying we would fetch a priest. We didn't, of course. Philippe and I went to Matthew and explained we could make him live forever, without pain, without suffering. Much later, Matthew told us he thought we were Jean the Baptist and the Blessed Mother come to take him to heaven to be with his wife and child. When I offered him my blood, he thought I was the priest offering him last rites.
The only sounds in the room were my quiet breathing and the crackle of logs in the fireplace. I wanted Isabeau to tell me the particulars of how she had made Matthew, but I was afraid to ask in case it was something that vampires didn't talk about. Perhaps it was too private or too painful. Isabeau soon told me without prompting.
He took my blood so easily, like he was born to it, she said with a rustling sigh. Matthew was not one of those humans who turned their face from the scent or sight. I opened my wrist with my own teeth and told him my blood would heal him. He drank his salvation without fear.
And afterward, I whispered.
Afterward he was,
Difficult, Isabeau said carefully. All new vampires are strong and full of anger, but Mathieu was almost impossible to control. He was in a rage at being a vampire, and his need to feed was endless. Philippe and I had to hunt all day for weeks to satisfy him.
And his body changed more than we expected. We all get taller, finer, stronger.
I was much smaller before I became a vampire, but Mathieu developed from a reed-thin human into a formidable creature. My husband was larger than my new son, but in the first flush of my blood, Mathieu was a handful even for Philippe. I forced myself not to shrink from Matthew's hunger and rage. Instead, my eyes remained fixed on his mother, not closing my eyes for an instant against the knowledge of him. This was what Matthew feared, that I would come to understand who he had been, who he still was, and feel revulsion.
What calmed him? I asked.
Philippe took him hunting, Isabeau explained, once he thought that Mathieu would no longer kill everything in his path. The hunt engaged his mind, and the chase engaged his body. He soon craved their hunt more than the blood, which is a good sign in young vampires. It meant he was no longer a creature of pure appetite, but was once again rational. After that, it was only a matter of time before his conscience returned, and he began to think before he killed. Then, all we had to fear were his black periods, when he felt the loss of Blanca and Lucas again and turned to humans to dull his anger.
Did anything help Matthew then?
Sometimes I sang to him, the same song I sang to you tonight, and others as well. That often broke the spell of his grief. Other times Matthew would go away. Philippe forbade me to follow or ask questions when he returned.
Isabeau's eyes were black as she looked at me. Our glances confirmed what we both suspected, that Matthew had been lost with other women, seeking solace in their blood and the touch of hands that belonged to neither his mother nor his wife.
He's so controlled, I mused aloud. It's hard to imagine him like that.
Mathieu feels deeply. It is a blessing as well as a burden to love so much that you can hurt so badly when love is gone.
There was a threat in Isabeau's voice. My chin went up in defiance, my fingers tingling.
Then I'll have to make sure my love never leaves him, I said tightly.
And how will you do that? Isabeau taunted. Would you become a vampire then and join us in our hunting?
She laughed, but there was neither joy nor mirth in the sound. No doubt that's what Domenico suggested.
One simple bite, the draining of your veins, the exchange of our blood for yours. The congregation would have no grounds to intrude on your business then.
What do you mean? I asked numbly.
Don't you see? Isabeau snarled. If you must be with Mathieu, then become one of us and put him and yourself out of danger. The witches may want to keep you as their own, but they cannot object to your relationship if you are a vampire too.
A low rumble started in Mart's throat.
Is that why Matthew went away? Did the congregation order him to make me a vampire?
Mathieu would never make you mange a song, Mart said scornfully,
her eyes snapping with fury.
No. Isabeau's voice was softly malicious. He has always loved fragile things, as I told you.
This was one of the secrets that Matthew was keeping. If I were a vampire, there would be no prohibitions looming over us, and thus no reason to fear the congregation. All I had to do was become something else. I contemplated the prospect with surprisingly little panic or fear. I could be with Matthew, and I might even be taller. Isabeau would do it. Her eyes glittered as she took in the way my hand moved to my neck. But there were my visions to consider, not to mention the power of the wind and the water. I didn't yet understand the magical potential in my blood, and as a vampire, I might never solve the mystery of Ashmole 782.
I promised him, Mart said, her voice rough. Diana must stay as she is, a witch.
Isabeau bared her teeth slightly, unpleasantly, and nodded. Did you also promise not to tell me what really happened in Oxford?
Matthew's mother scrutinized me closely. You must ask Matthew when he returns. It is not my tale to tell.
I had other questions as well, questions that Matthew might have been too distracted to mark as off-limits. Can you tell me why it matters that it was a creature who tried to break into the lab rather than a human? There was a silence while Isabeau considered my words. Finally, she replied,
Clever girl.
I did not promise Matthew to remain silent about appropriate rules of conduct, after all.
She looked at me with a touch of approval.
Such behavior is not acceptable among creatures. We must hope it was a mischievous demon who does not realize the seriousness of what he has done. Matthew might forgive that.
He has always forgiven demons, Mart muttered darkly.
What if it wasn't a demon?
If it was a vampire, it represents a terrible insult. We are territorial creatures. A vampire does not cross into another vampire's house or land without permission.
Would Matthew forgive such an insult?
Given the look on Matthew's face when he'd thrown a punch at the car, I suspected that the answer was no.
Perhaps, Isabeau said doubtfully.
Nothing was taken, nothing was armed, but it is more likely Matthew would demand some form of retribution.
Once more, I'd been dropped into the Middle Ages, with the maintenance of honor and reputation the primary concern.
And if it was a witch? I asked softly.
Matthew's mother turned her face away.
For a witch to do such a thing would be an act of aggression. No apology would be adequate.
Alarm bells sounded.
I flung the covers aside and swung my legs out of bed. The break-in was meant to provoke Matthew. He went to Oxford thinking he could make a good-faith deal with Knox. We have to warn him.
Isabeau's hands were firm on my knees and shoulder, stopping my motion.
He already knows, Diana.
That information settled in my mind. Is that why he wouldn't take me to Oxford with him? Is he in danger?
Of course he is in danger, Isabeau said sharply. But he will do what he can to put an end to this.
She lifted my legs back onto the bed and tucked the covers tightly around me.
I should be there, I protested.
You would be nothing but a distraction. You will stay here, as he told you.
Don't I get a say in this? I asked, for what seemed like the 100th time since I came to Set Tour.
No, both women said at the same moment.
You really do have a lot to learn about vampires, Isabeau said once again, but this time she sounded mildly regretful.
I had a lot to learn about vampires, this I knew. But who was going to teach me? And when?
Chapter 24 From afar, I beheld a black cloud covering the earth. It absorbed the earth and covered my soul as the seas entered, becoming putrid and corrupted at the prospect of hell and the shadow of death. A tempest had overwhelmed me, I read aloud from Matthew's copy of Aurora Consurgence. Turning to my computer, I typed notes about the imagery my anonymous author had used to describe Nigredo, one of the dangerous steps in alchemical transformation. During this part of the process, the combination of substances like mercury and lead gave off fumes that endangered the alchemist's health. Appropriately, one of Bourgo Lenoir's gargoyle-like faces pinched his nose tight shut, avoiding the cloud mentioned in the text.
Get your riding clothes on.
My head lifted from the pages of the manuscript.
Matthew made me promise to take you outdoors. He said it would help you from getting sick, Isabeau explained.
You don't have to, Isabeau. Domenico and the Witchwater have depleted my adrenaline supply, if that's your concern.
Matthew must have told you how alluring the smell of panic is to a vampire.
Marcus told me, I corrected her. Actually, he told me what it tastes like. What does it smell like?
Isabeau shrugged. Like it tastes. Maybe a bit more exotic, a touch of muskiness, perhaps. I was never much drawn to it. I prefer the kill to the hunt, but to each her own. I'm not having as many panic attacks these days. There's no need for you to take me riding. I turned back to my work.
Why do you think they have gone away? Isabeau asked.
I honestly don't know, I said with a sigh, looking at Matthew's mother.
You have been like this for a long time?
Since I was 7.
What happened then?
My parents were killed in Nigeria, I replied shortly.
This was the picture you received, the one that caused Matthew to bring you to Settur.
When I nodded in response, Isabeau's mouth flattened into a familiar hard line. Pigs. There were worse things to call them, but pigs did the job pretty well. And if it grouped whoever had sent me the photograph with Domenico Michele, then it was the right category.
Panic or no panic, Isabeau said briskly, we are going to exercise as Matthew wanted.
I powered off the computer and went upstairs to change. My riding clothes were folded neatly in the bathroom, courtesy of Mart, though my boots were in the stables, along with my helmet and vest. I slithered into the black breeches, added a turtleneck, and slipped on loafers over a pair of warm socks, then went downstairs in search of Matthew's mother.
"I'm in here," she called.
I followed the sound to a small room painted warm terracotta. It was ornamented with old plates, animal horns, and an ancient dresser large enough to store an entire inn's worth of plates, cups, and cutlery. Isabeau peered over the pages of Le Monde, her eyes covering every inch of me.
"Mart tells me you slept."
"Yes, thank you." I shifted from one foot to the other as if waiting to see the school principal to explain my misbehavior. Mart saved me from further discomfort by arriving with a pot of tea. She, too, surveyed me from head to foot.
"You are better today,"
she finally announced, handing me a mug. She stood there frowning until Matthew's mother put down her paper. And then she departed. When I was finished with my tea, we went to the stables. Isabeau had to help with my boots, since they were still too stiff to slide on and off easily, and she watched carefully while I put on my turtle shell of a vest and the helmet. Clearly, safety equipment had been part of Matthew's instructions. Isabeau, of course, wore nothing more protective than a brown quilted jacket. The relative indestructibility of vampire flesh was a boon if you were a rider. In the paddock, Fedat and Rakasa stood side by side, mirror images right down to the armchair-style saddles on their backs. "Isabeau," I protested, "George put the wrong tack on Rakasa. I don't ride side saddle."
"Are you afraid to try?"
Matthew's mother looked at me appraisingly.
"No,"
I said, tamping down my temper. "I just prefer to ride astride."
"How do you know?"
Her emerald eyes flickered with a touch of malice. We stood for a few moments, staring at each other. Rakasa stamped her hoof and looked over her shoulder. "Are you going to ride or talk?" she seemed to be asking. "Behave," I replied brusquely, walking over and putting her fetlock against my knee.
"George has seen to this," Isabeau said in a bored tone.
"I don't ride horses I haven't checked myself." I examined Rakasa's hooves, ran my hands over her reins, and slid my fingers under the saddle.
"Philippe never did either."
Isabeau's voice held a note of grudging respect. With poorly concealed impatience, she watched me finish. When I was done, she led Fedat over to a set of steps and waited for me to follow. After she'd helped me get into the strange contraption of a saddle, she hopped onto her own horse. I took one look at her and knew I was in for quite a morning. Judging from her seat, Isabeau was a better rider than Matthew, and he was the best I'd ever seen.
"Walk around," Isabeau said. "I need to make sure you won't fall off and kill yourself."
"Show a little faith, Isabeau."
"Don't let me fall," I bargained with Rakasa, "and I'll make sure you get an apple a day for the rest of your life."
My mount's ears shot forward, then back, and she nickered gently. We circled the paddock twice before I drew to a gentle stop in front of Matthew's mother.
"Satisfied?"
"You're a better rider than I expected," she admitted. "You could probably jump, but I promised Matthew we would not."
"He managed to wheedle a fair number of promises out of you before he left," I muttered, hoping she wouldn't hear me.
"Indeed," she said crisply. "Some of them harder to keep than others." We passed through the open paddock gate. George touched his cap to Isabeau and shut the gate behind us, grinning and shaking his head. Matthew's mother kept us on relatively flat ground while I got used to the strange saddle. The trick was to keep your body square, despite how off-kilter you felt. "This isn't too bad," I said after about 20 minutes.
"It is better now that the saddles have two pommels," Isabeau said. "Before, all side saddles were good for was being led around by a man."
Her disgust was audible.
"It was not until the Italian queen put a pommel and stirrup on her saddle that we could control our own horses. Her husband's mistress rode astride so she could go with him when he exercised. Catherine was always being left at home, which is most unpleasant for a wife."
She shot me a withering glance.
"Henri's whore was named after the goddess of the hunt, like you."
"I wouldn't have crossed Catherine de Medici," I shook my head.
"The king's mistress, Diane de Poitiers, was the dangerous one," Isabeau said darkly. "She was a witch."
"Actually or metaphorically?" I asked with interest. "Both," Matthew's mother said in a tone that could strip paint. I laughed. Isabeau looked surprised, then joined in. We rode a bit farther. Isabeau sniffed the air and sat taller in the saddle, her face alert. "What is it?" I asked anxiously, keeping Ricasa under a tight rein.
"Rabbit."
She kicked Fedot into a canter. I followed closely, reluctant to see if it was as difficult to track a witch in the forest as Matthew had suggested. We streaked through the trees and out into the open field. Isabeau held Fedot back, and I pulled alongside her.
"Have you seen a vampire kill?" Isabeau asked, watching my reaction carefully.
"No," I said calmly.
"Rabbits are small. That's where we'll begin. Wait here."
She swung out of the saddle and dropped lightly to the ground. Fedot stood obediently, watching her mistress.
"Diana," she said sharply, never taking her eyes off her prey, "do not come near me while I'm hunting or feeding. Do you understand?"
"Yes." My mind raced at the implications. Isabeau was going to chase down a rabbit, kill it, and drink its blood in front of me. Staying far away seemed an excellent suggestion. Matthew's mother darted across the grassy field, moving so fast it was impossible to keep her in focus. She slowed just as a falcon does in midair before it swoops in for the kill, then bent and grabbed a frightened rabbit by the ears. Isabeau held it up triumphantly before sinking her teeth directly into its heart. Rabbits may be small, but they're surprisingly bloody if you bite into them while they're still alive. It was horrifying. Isabeau sucked the blood out of the animal, which quickly ceased struggling, then wiped her mouth clean on its fur and tossed the carcass into the grass. 3 seconds later, she was swinging herself back into the saddle. Her cheeks were slightly flushed, and her eyes sparkled more than usual. Once mounted, she looked at me.
"Well," she asked, "shall we look for something more feeling, or do you need to return to the house?"
Isabeau de Clermont was testing me. "After you," I said grimly, touching Ricasa's flank with my heel. The remainder of our ride was measured not by the movement of the sun, which was still hidden behind clouds, but by the increasing amounts of blood Isabeau's hungry mouth drew from her kills. She was a relatively neat eater. Still, it would be some time before I was happy at the prospect of a large steak. I was numb to the sight of blood after the rabbit, the enormous squirrel-like creature that Isabeau told me was a marmot, the fox, and the wild goat. Or so I thought. When Isabeau gave chase to a young doe, however, something prickled inside me. "Isabeau," I protested, "you can't still be hungry. Leave it."
"What? The goddess of the hunt objects to my pursuit of her deer?"
Her voice mocked, but her eyes were curious. "Yes," I said promptly.
"I object to your hunting of my son. See what good that has done."
Isabeau swung down from her horse. My fingers itched to intervene, and it was all I could do to stay out of Isabeau's way while she stalked her prey. After each kill, her eyes revealed that she wasn't completely in command of her emotions or her actions. The doe tried to escape. It almost succeeded by darting into some underbrush, but Isabeau frightened the animal back into the open. After that, fatigue put the doe at a disadvantage. The chase touched off something visceral within me.
Isabeau killed swiftly, and the doe didn't suffer, but I had to bite my lip to keep from shouting.
There, she said with satisfaction, returning to Fadat. We can go back to Settur.